I was playing a monster. I was playing Frankenstein's monster. I was naked and painted green, and this agency still took me on. So I owe Evans and Rice a lot.
Welcome to Story and Craft. Now, here's your host, Mark Preston.
All right, here we go. Back after it. Story and Craft. I'm Mark Preston. Good to have you here. It's been a little bit, took a few weeks, a little holiday hiatus, but it got extended because I got COVID. Seems like I'm one of the last people who's gotten it done. It took me a second to bounce back, but here we are. Also, I was in Los Angeles, took a little time with my youngest daughter, Emma. We went for the World of VoiceOver, the That's VoiceOver conference, did a little speaking. People had to put up with me on stage. And the Voice Arts Awards, that was fun to go to. And as always, bounced around Los Angeles with my daughter and ate as much good stuff as we could. So back here after a short break, and I had an opportunity to chat with Tom Brooke, who is in the new Sam Mendes movie, Empire of Light. Really enjoyed the conversation. You know, Tom has been in great movies. One of my favorite movies about radio of all time, Pirate Radio. We discussed what it was like to work with Philip Seymour Hoffman. You might have also seen Tom in TV shows like Bodyguard, Preacher, The Crown. A very talented guy. Great chat. Enjoy the opportunity to sit down with Tom. By the way, don't forget everything Story and Craft. Make sure to go to Story and Craft. pod.com. All the socials, all the info, what's going on, pretty much the whole world of Story and Craft is right there. Okay, so let's get after it. It's Tom Brooke Day on Story and Craft. So how you doing today?
Pretty good. How are you?
Very good, actually. Very, you know, it's after Christmas and the things are just kind of like, they feel like they kind of slow down a little bit, you know, but still trying to get work done, you know.
We had our first Thanksgiving ever this year.
So you aren't in the UK, you're over here now.
Boston.
How'd you end up in Boston?
My wife does a TV show here called Julia, about Julia Child. It's on HBO. We've all come over. Our daughter's at school here as well. And
how old's your daughter?
She's 7 now.
Okay.
We were all here last year for season 1. And then we all came back for season 2. Same apartment, same school for her, same friends.
I have to ask because I have a 17-year-old who's that's my youngest.
Wow.
And so I know. Well, she's not 17 yet. She will be in 7 days. So
is that right?
I've got three. I call my little people, but my son's almost taller than me, and I'm 6'2". So, I've got two at Loyola University in New Orleans, and my youngest is graduating a year early. And I don't know where she's going, but she's But it is. I remember the 7-year-old age range is it easy for her to adapt? I mean, moving from school to school is one thing, but going from country to country to a new school is another.
I mean, she constantly amazes me. And that's one of the things that she seems to be okay with. I mean, we haven't given her much of an option.
Well, kids are adaptable, especially during COVID. I think last few years, kids have had to adapt. I mean, I think they've done a better job than we have to some degree.
Yeah, I agree.
I kind of want to go to something as a former radio guy. I got to say, I am so envious that you were in pirate radio. That is a young, okay, I think I was 7 years old, wanted to do radio. And I, you know, listened to kind of the stories of the old guys. You know, I kind of started and came up with, I was pretty successful pretty early on. And I had a syndicated show when I was like only 20 or 21, my first one. But I was working with guys who worked in the 70s and the 80s and some in the 60s. And boy, the stories they would tell. And it's almost like a little snapshot. And people would look at pirate radio and go, ah, that's malarkey. Yeah, that didn't really happen. Like that kind of stuff happened. But to be on a set with that cast, you know, playing make-believe, that had to have been just a blast.
Yeah. It's the first time and only time I've got a car and a speedboat to work, because they bought a boat, you know, the ship, they brought it down from Scotland, and they just parked it off the south coast of England.
I'm very curious, did they shoot the interiors in the boat, or did they do that on a soundstage?
A bit of both.
But Philip Seymour Hoffman, I got to say, that is, I always wanted to work with that kind of a character in my career. And but as an actor, just kind of before we get into it, I'm just curious, what was it like working on that movie? Because that's, for me, just like a little gem. If it ever comes on, I just watch it no matter where I find it. It's just one of those movies.
Oh, I've got them. Oh, how lovely. That's so nice to hear. I've got those too. The thing I remember about him most was the first day. I remember coming into the studio and he was just there. And his first scene was him at the microphone commiserating about the fact that they were all going to be locked down by the government. And I said, "Are you nervous?" Because I just couldn't help it. Like, I just thought, like, he said, "No." He said, "Of course I am. You must be joking. It doesn't ever get any easier." And I thought, God, blimey, even you. But I don't know. He's so good in that film. And, you know, getting the chance to watch it happen right in front of you is really special. I mean, you ask about how it was when we were filming it, and we sort of had carte blanche to do whatever we wanted, really. And there is a cut somewhere out there that's 5.5 hours long.
No kidding, really?
Yeah, I think the first cut was actual
cut together footage, or is it just like outtakes and things like that?
No, it's footage. It's
I really. Think,
yeah, because he kept saying, like, okay, great, yeah, no, let's have that, and do that again, that's brilliant, and da 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 da. And so I think by the end of it, he had so much footage because he just, everyone was offering stuff up, and he seemed really, I don't know, he seemed like he was really, really up for it, so...
I mean, just the casting on that. I mean, January Jones and then Kenneth Branagh and Bill Nye.
Jones pops up, doesn't she? My God, yeah, that was huge.
The cast was just so perfect. And then I'm thinking, Chris O'Dowd still ranks up there in the top five guys I want to sit down and have a beer with. So, you know, or a pint. I'm sorry, I should say it properly.
A pint, yes, you have to. Or a Guinness. I remember Bill Nye being very, very sweet. We had a chat on board the boat one day in between takes about what our different books were that we were reading in our downtime. And he sounded really interesting. And when I got back to the trailer that night, there was a copy of it waiting for me.
But no, I mean, it's so fun when people want to share their special thing with you, you know, like their wisdom. And people do that with books a lot. For me, it's kind of movies and TV shows. I know I should be a bigger reader. I'm just not right now. I know raising three kids, it's like, you know, I sit down and finally open up the book at night. 3 seconds later, I'm asleep.
I know what you mean. Yeah.
It's like Ambien or something, you know. But just kind of going a little origin story. Now, you know, where in the UK did you grow up?
London. I grew up in London, and I'm still in London. I took as many opportunities to get out and see the country as much as possible. But that's me. Yeah, that's my base.
Now, is that where your people are from? Are your folks from there, or did they?
They're from England, but my mum grew up on the south coast, and her family are still around there. They moved around a bit. They ran pubs. And my dad's dad was in the army, so they moved around a bit as well. So, but mum and dad met at university at King's in London.
Well, and, I did see your father he's also in the business. He's an actor. And I always find that tremendously interesting to find out whether or not I look like a Tom Hanks or, you know, and Colin Hanks, you know, all these other folks that was there encouragement like, yes, go ahead and do this thing. You know, if you got passion for it, go for it. Or was there pushback? Because I know the people that I know are like, God, I don't know if I wouldn't want my kid to do this. You know, this is a, this is definitely a lifestyle that you really need to want to do it. Was there encouragement, or did he try to discourage you from following the thespianic arts?
He was definitely encouraging. He was so impressive in that way, especially like you say, like raising your own. You sort of go, "Wow, thanks," because he never discouraged me, but he always made it clear that it was a job. Mm-hmm. You had to work really hard at it. You could get better at it if you wanted to, but one of the things that I think it was very clear about, and I could see firsthand, was that it was, to a certain extent, in the lap of the gods. So if you were prepared to acknowledge and accept all of that, go for it. That seemed to just transform into sort of basically support for me. Right.
Well, what was the genesis of your interest? Were you just watching him, or was it that you were watching movies or stage work and that's what grabbed you?
He started me off in the theater early. He was always taking me to things. They both were. And I guess occasionally I'd go backstage maybe if we'd gone to see some friends of theirs. But I used to love movies, really. I used to love movies. And it was a really magical time then. You know, it was when movies came out in America first. You had to wait. Or you had to quiz everybody that had come back from a holiday in the States. What did you see? What did you see? What did you see on the plane? Because these movies, you'd have to wait 6 months before they came out in England. All of that stuff I found really, really sort of enticing. But it was a teacher that just said, "You should audition for this school play." And I did. And I got the part, and my voice broke on stage, and I got a laugh out of it. And I thought,
"Well, it's memorable. Yeah. Now it's a story you get to tell."
Yeah.
But at that age, it's horrifying, probably, you know, and having that much attention, you know, adolescence can just be kind of awkward enough, you know.
Actually, no, I know what you mean, but actually, I was surprisingly comfortable on stage, and I remember not feeling anxious on stage, regardless of where else in my life I was feeling anxious at the time. On stage, I didn't feel anxious because of Dad. You know, I'd done so much work on the part, and I'd learnt the lines to within an inch of my life. And so, by that point, I was really interested in just like showing them what I'd done with the words, like the choices I'd made. So, and that hasn't really changed, to be honest.
When you started, was there an end game going, "I want to be on camera, I want to do the movie thing," or were you just in it and just kind of see where it takes you, you know, because you got stage people, you got the folks who want to be on camera, you know, when they're young, you know, kind of the aspiration.
Yeah.
Did you have any specific goals?
I had a few. I did. And I, amazingly, I managed to tick almost all of them off within, I don't know what, the first 7 or 8 years of doing it. There are a few that are ongoing, but I wanted to make sure that I played a lead in every theatre in London that was on my list. I wanted to start early and show them that I could do it all. And I remember Dad talking to me about that a lot and saying, If you have a fair wind, you can do a play. If the play goes well, you can use that success to jump into maybe a bit of telly or maybe a little bit in a movie. And then if that does well, you can use that and you can jump to another one. And he said, like, you know, with a good agent, that's as good a game plan as you can have, really. So early on, I made sure I did a little bit of everything just as a kind of calling card. and that worked.
When you were growing up, though, what were you watching? Because you mentioned the thing about how movies get released and how, you know, the folks in the UK, you know, you're just kind of behind the eight ball. And I always wondered why they did that. I'm like, why don't they just release at the same time everywhere? But what were you watching when you were a kid? What was kind of grabbing your attention, stuff shot in the UK or US?
What was I growing up with? I was growing up with stuff that Dad was in. So I was watching bits and pieces. His telly career, he stopped doing theatre in sort of in the 80s and carried on just with telly and film. So I'd watch stuff that he was in. Batman was huge for me. I'd watch Adam West religiously every single Saturday morning.
So if you're talking about the OG Batman, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And Burt Ward, Burgess Meredith. All these people, you look Vincent Price, you look back and go, wow, they were in that, wow. But I don't know, really, it was just, it was telly, and then it was any movies that were a big deal. I remember the first Batman was huge. Dad took me to the Barbican and we watched that, and Michael Keaton forever.
Oh, yeah. My son's really into the all of the, I want to say that stuff, the superhero stuff, you know,
the kind of comic books and
yeah
adaptations,
and
but
a lot of people look at Michael Keaton as is really the guy, you know. People say who was the best Batman, people like Michael Keaton. I love Michael Keaton, so I'll say he's my guy.
Did you see him in Dope Sick? I saw that just.
No, you know, that is that.
Oh my God.
Thank you for reminding me. I've gone through and make sure I have so many shows and stuff I've bookmarked on the streamers going, this is what I got to watch. I so want to watch that. But everything, he's one of those few guys he's in. No matter what he's in, I'm going to see it.
Yeah, he's really special, isn't he? He's one of those ones.
Indeed. Now, real quick about your mother. Was she an actor, or is she an actor as well?
No, she acted at school and at uni. She went into teaching. And quite early on, she got noticed for being management material, and then she went down that direction, and she was a vice principal of a sixth form college, and then she took early retirement, and she passed last year, but she just got her PhD.
Really?
Yeah, just before the illness took her. So she is very special. Very, very special.
My condolences on that. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's my father passed from COVID back. We kind of went into this weird the last few years. It's just almost like, kind of feel like coming out of a fog. Like, okay, now we're kind of back to a little bit more normal, you know. And
was it COVID? Was it COVID?
I appreciate it. Yeah, no matter how you lose a parent, it's never easy. It's definitely you remind you life is a continual education. With your father doing this, and then you ended up marrying someone who does this as well, you know. So I got a question. When you were having family dinners, is there a rule of no talking shop, or is that something that's a frequent topic, you know?
I feel like there should have been. There wasn't. My mom was very understanding. My dad, he loves to tell stories, and he's got some great ones. He did a scene with Brando, you know.
Really? No kidding.
Yeah, he did a scene with Brando.
What film was that in?
Dry White Season, with Donald Sutherland as well. It's funny because Mum never talked about her work, and I've always kind of wondered whether how much of that was her not wanting to, and or whether it was she didn't have the space to, because he was constantly anecdoting, but. It made for a very happy table either way, but we certainly talk shop, my wife and I, And Dad retired himself about 8-10 years ago, which was, I haven't heard of an actor retiring themselves before, which I thought was interesting. And he was psychologically definitely much better off, I think, as a result. The business didn't retire him, you know what I mean?
Yeah. I think, didn't Gene Hackman decide he just got retired? I think,
oh, that, yes, he retired to Santa Fe. That's right.
Yeah, there's some people, and there's somebody else I heard of. I was thinking, what, doing this and being creative and expressing and all that stuff, and I wonder, how, do you go stir crazy in retirement, or is it just freeing, you know, after all the years of going and doing the, having the kind of routine of what the life an actor has to live, you know, the traveling, yeah, and the, you know, the industry itself. But is he enjoying retirement?
Yeah, I think that, you know, after he had a very, very, very good run. And I feel like, you know, if you're not getting the parts that you want, or you feel like you should, then you've got to make a decision. And I think his decision was just, you know what, let's draw a line. It's been great. And, you know, let's be a bit careful with money, and hope it will be okay. And touch wood, so far it has been.
Did you have any siblings growing up, or did
no, just me?
Me, really? Only child here, also. Yeah, so that's
really. Oh, no way.
Indeed, yeah. And we're kind of a unique tribe. Everybody says, "Oh, you're spoiled. You're an only child." It's like, oh, no. It's a.
I know.
I think.
Go on.
Oh no. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say. Quite often, I hear people slagging off only children to me. And they're like, you know, only children. Oh, fucking, you know, and you're like, really? I'm one of them. And they're like, oh, are we?
Well, you got to be your self-contained unit. You know, a lot of folks, I think the ones that do get spoiled a lot of times, and now it's, you know, I will say in my family, I make sure I don't do that. But the youngest child a lot of times is, because the oldest ones usually catch all the heat early on. By the time you get to the third one, the parents like, do whatever the hell you want, you know? And
yeah.
So, but no, the only child, you get everything. I think you, especially growing up in the 80s, I think as an only child, you're probably, you know, fiercely independent, you know, or you learn how to be independent. So maybe that's one advantage, you know.
I couldn't see an issue, I have to say. First day of secondary school when I was 11, and the teacher said, hands up, who's got brothers and sisters? And I was at the front of the class, and I turned around, and almost everybody had their hands up. And that was the first time I thought, oh, I might be in a minority here. But, yeah, freedom, independence. Absolutely. One of the things that one of the parents here in Boston was talking to me about, we have an only child ourselves, and so do they. And he sent me a New York Times article about when it's just the three of you, they're a little bit more like a sort of young adult, in that it helps to maybe like include them in decision making in that way, because there's three of you, and that sort of rang some bells. So we do that very much, and we make sure that we're all sort of on the same page as a three, rather than two parents and a,
you know,
and a
that's
kid,
that's a really possible. Wonderful idea, and it's something I've actually tried to do myself. Is you know, of course, you know, you're the parent, you get the tie breaking vote, you know, naturally,
yeah.
But but it's nice, because it kind of, you know, I involve my kids, and even the things I think are boring, you know, like,
yeah,
they can come into my studio, they kind of see kind of how business runs and all the stuff I do, and
that's cool.
Just it's the idea they have some agency in the whole process, you know, and that way, especially for girls, I think it's even more important, because, you know, I'm adamant, big girl power fan. Like, now you know,
too.
You've got to know how to handle my daughter. She's hostessing at a restaurant now, and she's just loving it. You know, she thinks it's the neatest thing at this kind of fine dining restaurant. And I said, we're going to sit down. I'm going to show you how to, you know, get the financial software up, enter your paycheck. So why do I need to do that? It's like, because you need to know how to do this, so you don't have to rely on somebody else to do it for you, and you're more in control of your own destiny. That way. She's looking at me like, well, when she looked up from her phone, but she, But no, she's a smart kid. But yeah, I think it's really important to do that. But she's 7, you say? She's 7 years old?
She's 7. How old yours then? Yours, you said your daughter's
19, going to be 20 here soon, 18, just turned 18 and almost 17. So, girl, boy, girl.
Okay.
And a 10-year-old golden retriever, can't forget him. So, you know, he's in the he's in the mix too.
Don't forget the dogs. we got sisters.
You have goldens?
No, their mom's a whippet staff and their dad's a lab boxer.
Wow. Okay, so you have a nice mix there.
Yeah, there's a lot going on, but they oh my god, can't forget.
Did
they
make the journey across the Atlantic with you?
They made the journey across the Irish Sea to dog sitters in and on the south coast of Ireland in Tipperary, and then they're there at the week, and then at the weekends they go to my in-laws, and they all love them. So it's worked out really well.
Gosh, I don't know how long I can go without seeing my pooch. I'm a big dog guy. Always had dogs around.
My god, me too.
Now, speaking of traveling and coming over here, I saw you were in Preacher, and I auditioned for that. And I can't remember. Did they shoot that in Louisiana?
No.
Yeah, I did. I can't even count the callbacks I got. I mean, a number. I mean, the casting people were down with me, but you know the way it works. So you just.
Yeah.
There's so many variables, but I was very intrigued by it. But I don't know, did it shoot in Louisiana or Georgia? I can't remember.
It was going to be Georgia, and then it was Albuquerque for season.
Was it
one?
I know they did different. They moved it at some point in time,
and then,
from season to season.
That's right. Yeah, season 2 was New Orleans.
Okay, that's what I auditioned for, because that's where I am.
Oh, okay, so you were going for season 2.
Yep. So did you shoot just one season, or did you do more? I
did the pilot and season 1 in Albuquerque. Then I went to New Orleans to be killed off. That was very difficult, very difficult. But then I got called back. Would you like to come back for season 4? And that was in Melbourne, Australia.
No. Okay.
So Preacher has taken me across the world and back. It was amazing.
I've always wanted to be an expat for a little while, and Australia's always been the destination. I think it would be so. That or Thailand, I think it'd be kind of fun.
Melbourne is incredible.
I teach voiceover, and I've worked with students in Melbourne, Sydney, Perth, and Canberra. And everybody, the Sydney people are like, oh, yeah, no, don't go to Melbourne. And Melbourne's like, Sydney people are stuck up. You know, it's just kind of funny to hear them kind of, you know, digging on each other. But now, what did you think of New Orleans when you were shooting here?
Loved it. My God, that place, that's not like anywhere else on earth, is it? I had marching bands going past the window of the hotel.
You must have been around during Mardi Gras, I'm assuming.
Yeah.
God, good God, bless you. That's nuts.
What a time to be there. It was amazing. Absolutely amazing. And my daughter has all the beads still from the floats, you know, they're throwing the beads out. And
for any little kid who comes in, it's got to be magical. But when you live here and you're an adult dealing with traffic, it's a whole different thing.
you know, I can imagine.
Believe it or not, a lot of people in New Orleans actually leave during Mardi Gras. That's a big vacation time just to get the heck out of the melee.
Yeah, but there's like the further out you go, there's that huge, there's that park, and suddenly everything's peaceful and kind of low key.
It's neighborhood by neighborhood.
I loved it.
Going back to when you were growing up in London, you went to school for theater, correct? I mean, this was something that, I mean, you didn't go to just a general, you know, general a liberal arts studies. You went for theater, correct?
Yeah, I did a drama degree at university, and then after that, my dad was very insistent that I ought to know, because acting training in the UK is basically a theatre acting training. He thought I ought to know how to use my voice properly, so it didn't pack up on me like his had. when he was at the RSC. He had a vocal issue, which caused him a lot of problems. And so he was saying, like,
Well, in theater, that's, but you're projecting to the back of the house, you know. You're it's a much different thing. Yeah.
yeah, and you've got to do it every night, 8 shows a week. So that was, I went to university to do drama, but they didn't really do that. They didn't really teach you about how to use your voice. There was some physical stuff as well, but I did 2 years after uni at a drama school in London, and lived at home again. And yeah, managed to get an agent from that last showcase. I was playing a monster. I was playing Frankenstein's monster. I was naked and painted green, and this agency still took me on. So I owe Evans and Rice a lot. Thank you, Jan Evans.
That's, well, again, you got a good story of, you know, they cast him after seeing me naked. They were like all kinds of down for me. No, so do you have a preference for stage or on camera? As things have gone on, do you have a preference, or do you just kind of like the contrast and kind of go back and forth? Does it make a difference to you?
I like the variety of it. I like the different opportunities. I like the different people, the different groups of people, and the way they sometimes interlink. All of that I really love. Theatre is, like I was saying before, like I feel really comfortable on stage. I don't quite know why, but I do. And I'm always happy to be there. But you can't really make a living on theatre money, so you just have to, as like, you just have to try and get acting work on front of a camera.
Yeah, for me, memorizing an entire script for me was just, it always was kind of an intimidating thing, you know. I like the, oh, you only have 2 pages? Pfft, I got that. No, not, oh, you want to change a line here? That, you know, anything more than that, my brain starts going, I'm going to give you a hard time now. It's like, I've tried
It's so
every,
unfair,
I have
isn't
all
it?
these little, I have so many different little techniques of trying to memorize, you know, memorize stuff. To the one that seems to work is actually writing it down, because I guess your brain imprints or something like that. Actually write this, you know. And I just, if people looked at my sides, they'd be like, "What is wrong with you?" All these little highlighting things to memorize, you know, it's a whole thing. But going forward now, your new project, The Empire of Light, being a Sam Mendes project, that's like, you know, he's one of those guys that actors, you know, there's some directors out there actors really want to work with, you know, and he seems to be one of the guys, one of the names that pops up a lot. How did you get on this project? What was, how did this gel together for you?
I had worked with Sam at the National. We'd done King Lear together on stage. So that was a long job as well. It was about 5 months. So we had about 8 weeks rehearsal and then previews, and then it ran in rep. So we were together for quite a while, and we got on really well, and I really liked him. And actually, it was weird because Mum had passed away, and I was not really in a headspace where I was thinking about work. And then this script came through about his mum, and I thought, oh, wow, I wonder why that sort of appeared in my life right now. And yeah, went to meet him for a cup of tea, and he said, do you want to do it?
Now, is this project in some way, you said based on his mother, or is it circle around a mother as a character within the film?
Yeah, there's a mother within the film, and there's a young boy within the film, and his experiences of childhood have kind of coloured the film. So it's not autobiographical, but it's definitely we were talking about mums a lot. And I was at that stage, I was really up for doing that. I was really up for doing it in the audition, actually. Well, audition, but we did it. I think he let me talk about mum for about an hour because I hadn't seen him since the play. And he said, "How you doing?" And I said, "Not great." I'm I'm pretty raw at the minute. And he said, oh no, what's going on? And I told him, and yeah, it was like a little therapy session.
Well, that begs the question: Does the acting, is it kind of a little bit of an escape for you? A little bit, you know. Some people, it can be. You can kind of depart whatever's going on in life for a moment, and so it's kind of in its own way therapeutic. Or when stuff's going on in life, does it kind of, do you feel, hinder your ability to do what you need to do on camera?
That's a really interesting question. I have always felt that I've got the jobs that I've got because of where I was at that point in my life when they came along. And so I feel like you can use, if you're lucky, you can use whatever's going on in your life, really, or what's gone on before that in your life. When you get up, I like that very much. I like taking things that have happened to me or feelings that I've had and putting them into a script, you know, like putting them into a performance. And usually when I read a script, it will be, I'll be noticing things about it that, you know, remind me of myself. So I sort of go, oh, okay, yeah, I know how to do this because I felt that once, you know.
So do the projects kind of act like, it sounds like they can act like a little bit of a mark on the timeline for you. You know, they're not just, oh, I did that job, but what was going on, the experience, the people you met, and all that kind of stuff. So
Yeah.
yeah, it takes on a new meaning, or more enhanced meaning, I guess.
Yeah, I think that's true. For example, I met my wife playing husband and wife on a play. Good casting.
I think that would be so cool to meet someone like that. But after you're married, can you do that and not get sick of each other? You know, I mean, if you're doing, let's say, a play and you're coming home and you're 24/7 with this person, is
That
that
is the
something you're like,
test.
I don't know if I could do that?
That is the test. But yeah, I wouldn't be able to do it without one. So and it's, you know, it's really, I think it's great as well because you get it. I get it when she's got a lot on. She gets it when I've got a lot on. We help each other through it because we both get it.
That's got to be such a cool experience. So yeah, that'd be kind of like its own little fairy tale kind of a thing. You know, it's like
Yeah.
I do this thing, they do this thing, we got together and it worked, you know.
Yeah.
But I was curious on Empire of Light, you know, with Sam Mendes directing that. First of all, was it shot in the UK, or where did y'all shoot that?
In Margate, which is a seaside town on the southeast coast of England.
And that's roughly, you said your mother's from the southern coast as well, correct?
Yeah, she's a bit further along, but they're in Worthing, the Lawsons in Worthing, and we were just up the coast in Margate. But we, yeah, it was in, I thought it was interesting because I hadn't done any filming with Sam, and his approach was very similar to the play that we did, in that it started with a few weeks around the table, just talking about the script and reading it and making changes. There was a great book that he had when we were doing the King Lear, which allowed you to swap words out and put words back in that kept the meter. But if a word was odd and people didn't quite understand it because it was so old, he just said, change it to something that does work, that does sort of scan, and that doesn't take you out of the moment whilst you try and figure out what it means.
I mean, that's certainly going to help you be more authentic, because if a word's just not naturally wanting to come out, that, you know, he kind of, you know, it kind of breaks your
Yeah,
flow a little bit.
get rid of it. And also, if the audience are listening, that happens to me all the time, especially in Shakespeare. Like, you hear a word and you spend the next three lines trying to figure out what on earth it meant. And by that point, you've lost those three lines. You don't know what's going on, and you slowly begin to lose interest. So, I don't know. It was a really impressive, simple, impressive tool just to making sure that everybody was remained on board, sort of cast and audience. And he did the same thing with this. There was lots of back and forth, lots of chat about how people think about how people saw the different characters, and that was fascinating, hearing other characters talking about your character or other people's characters, how they saw it. And then when we got onto the set, all the work had sort of been done.
His films, I've always found, the look or the aesthetic of them has always been just, like, even something like to go to Baby Driver or to the Bond films. And they have a certain aesthetic to them. Yeah. Which brings me the question, did you kind of pick his brain going, like, you know, you got a direct line to the Broccoli organization there. They're looking for a Bond, you know, just kind of throwing it out there.
No, I didn't manage to do that. There was always seemed to be just something else to do before I made the leap to ask him about Bond. But we talked about movies a lot. I mean, he's worked with a fair few greats. He's got great stories. He's got really filthy jokes, which is, I always sort of feel like it's so surprising, because you sort of see him accepting awards here, there, and everywhere. But the ability to tell a really filthy joke, I think, is one of his main strengths. But yeah, I mean, the look of this one is him and Roger Deakins together, and that was a moment. I mean,
does he use the same? Is that the DP he uses on all of his?
He's used him before, but Roger Deakins did all of the Coen Brothers films.
Oh, really? Okay.
And so, for me, he was sort of the person that I was most starstruck by on set. And I found it really...
All their films have a very specific aesthetic as well, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's fascinating because they're all so different, but they're also unique. The look of them, aren't they? Like, I don't know, Hudsucker Proxy is so different to the Big Lebowski. I found it really... I was really nervous around him because... he's sort of a part of movie history, and it was silly, but it was the first time I actually got to say I'm such a fan was at the screening of the movie. And I had to, say, like, look, I'm really sorry. I couldn't really talk to you during the film. You're such a hero, but I was so.
Well, I tell you, Hail Caesar for me, aesthetically, that was like, everything was just perfect with that one.
Isn't it? But they're perfect movies. I mean, like, Channing Tatum in Hail Caesar.
You see, I was thinking about George Clooney. You know, it's like randomness, him showing up, and it's just those films. Occasionally, when I speak with folks like yourself, I'm like, "Yeah, I gotta go watch that movie."
Yeah,
and I'll end up going and watching it, and that's the reason why I fall behind on every show I need to be watching and keeping up on. I'm like,
because of the movies. That's interesting.
Exactly.
So you go to a movie first.
Now, a couple of last questions. Now, how long have you been in Boston? This go around this day.
This time we did, we will have done just under 4 months when we leave.
Okay.
Because they started season two of Julia in France. So they started started in Cannes, and then we joined when our daughter had when the summer holidays turned up, and then we went to Paris, which was, I thought, pretty magical. I hope she did as well. It was quite hot, and I sometimes I wonder if us walking around going, look, Paris, it kind of got a bit old.
You're still making memories, and I'm sure she's taking pictures, and that'll, you know. Curious, when you're here, what is it that you do when you're in the US that you can't do in the UK that you really enjoy?
I think being in America, just in general, I find Americans really just the most welcoming people. I love how open everybody is and how you can strike up a conversation with almost anybody. I really enjoy a little holiday away from the more reserved approach to being a human being that perhaps English people have.
But real quick, before we get going, I always do my I have a quick 7 questions here. I always ask, just a little extra get to know you, if you will. the first question is always, you know, and I'm very curious because you are from the UK and I'm a food guy. What is your favorite comfort food?
That would have been mum's spag bol, spaghetti bolognese. It was just standard, very simple, but absolutely perfect. And a trifle.
I have heard the spag bol. One other person spoken with, they had to explain what that was. Like, oh, spaghetti. Oh, yeah, I know what that is. But yeah. Spag bol, never heard it called that before. But I've had somebody else say that.
And is trifle a thing over here?
The layered kind of dessert thing.
With custard. Yeah. Cold custard.
I think even in the South, it's a big thing. I don't know if they call it a trifle, but it's a, yeah.
Okay.
Without a doubt. Now, if you were to sit down and you're going to talk story with three folks, sitting down, having a cup of coffee for a few hours, who would those three people be, living or not, that you would love to sit down with?
Can I say Walter Matthau and Jack Lemmon?
Getting the two of them together would make it a more interesting, for the films they've made. Yeah, that's
one of the pluses, I think, of Dad, because he's one of the many, but he would quite often just pass me things that he'd taped from the telly. And say, watch this. And one of the ones was The Front Page with Jack Lemmon and Walter Matthau, a Billy Wilder movie, which remains absolutely top three.
Going back to when you were a young guy, next question. Who was your first celebrity crush?
Oh, the lead singer of Transvision Vamp.
Transvision Vamp.
Do you remember them? Wendy. Yeah, it's like a UK punk band. Are you doing it? Are you Googling it?
Or I had to Google if I... Oh, okay. A lovely lady. Now I'm going to have to go listen. I'm a music guy, so I want to go listen and find out what that's all about. Yeah, because we grew up in that era where that was punk. But that was ground zero in London for a lot of that, yeah.
What was her second name? Wendy something.
Wendy James.
Wendy James.
Yeah, Wendy... Yeah.
James.
So that's it. I just learned something. I love learning things. If you're going to be, next question, if you're going to be going to exotic island, somewhere you really want to be, but they don't have streaming, if you want to watch a movie, you're going to have to bring a DVD. If you want to listen to music, you're going to have to bring a CD. Full year, you're going to be there. With the whole family, you're going to enjoy yourself. But what would the CD, what would the album be, and what would the movie be that you would bring with you?
Oh, wow. The movie would probably be Miller's Crossing. Coen Brothers again. The plotting of that movie is so intricate. It never gets old for me, that movie. And Albert Finney's in it, and John Turturro's in it. And I think it's one of those movies where just across the board, everybody is just perfect. So I'd take Miller's Crossing, and the CD. Oh, the CD is tough.
Transvision Vamp. No, I'm just kidding.
I was going down that route because I feel like I'm playing our daughter all of these 80s songs at the minute. So I'd probably try and take, do you remember, did you ever have these over here? Now That's What I Call Music.
Oh my God. The compilation CDs. Yeah.
So there was a great one called Now That's What I Call Music 10. I just remember number 10 was huge. And that would be a good mix. Four tapes. I think she'd get a lot out of that one as well. So that would be my.
Isn't that fun when you can take the music that meant something to you, play it for your kid, and it's funny though. My youngest, for whatever reason, me being from Texas originally, she loves country music.
Okay.
And it's the funniest thing. I was speaking with, I think it was Billy Bob Thornton, talking about he has a 17-year-old daughter as well. We were talking about what it was that our kids are listening to. We're just talking about music. And my daughter, she's like, I love country. I was like, well, I'm going to educate you, on some of the stuff that was popular back in the day. And a kick on a song from a group called Brooks and Dunn. It's called Neon Moon.
Okay.
And I start playing it, and as she starts kind of singing it, and I was like, how do you know this song? I mean, this is like, she's like, oh, TikTok. That's how these kids are learning about music, is they hear tracks on TikTok. But it's cool because for them, some of the stuff is new and it doesn't have a lot of dust on it in their mind if it's on TikTok,
Oh, God, how interesting.
Yeah, that's what I call music. I still hear those commercials in my head. That's what I call music.
That's right. Yeah, me too.
Now, next question is, what's your definition of a perfect day from time you get up to the time you put your head down on the pillow, what are the component parts of a perfect day for you?
I'd be doing a play, I think. I'd have a play to go to in the evening. And during the day, I'd go for lunch with my wife. We'd drop our daughter at school, and I'd just about have time to pick her up before going in and doing a play. And then maybe somebody had come to see the play, a friend, and I'd go out for a cup of tea with them afterwards. That'd be perfect.
I've always wanted to do the high tea in England. That's still on the bucket list.
If that's on the list, you must do that. I've become a huge fan of iced tea over here. Unsweetened iced tea. Not a thing in England.
Okay, unsweetened, yeah. Down in the South, like, they always assume you want sweet. I was like, I don't need that much sugar in my life. You know, I'm the same way. Now, if you weren't doing what you're doing now, what would you be doing as a vocation? What would you be doing for a living?
Primary school teacher. No question.
Following in your mother's footsteps, yeah. as an educator.
But that kids at that age, there's so much joy and fun.
They're sponges at that age. You know, they're just soaking it all up. Yeah.
And we go to a play, like, she's so chatty to people that we'll go to a playground, and, you know, within like half an hour, there's this little gang and they're all chasing me and chucking stuff at me and, you know, spearing me with sticks. And it's just heaven.
You know, what's crazy is when you can remember kids doing that, and they're just like wacky little weird kids, and they're fun and everything. Now, you know, all these kids live on Instagram my friends. And so you kind of it's funny because you kind of, you know, as a parent, you have to somewhat like keep an eye on what is the ecosystem on my child. What are they dealing with?
Yeah.
What are they, you know? And you see these kids, like, dear God, they're now off almost to college, and they're like, they're real human beings now. But I remember when they were goofy little kids. It's weird. Again, it's like, you know, it must mean I'm getting older as well, which I refuse to accept. Yeah.
When at what age did you give them phones?
Lily, my oldest Lily, she had one when she was 12, 13, I think, is when she had one a little younger, just for a safety thing. It was a little flip phone. It wasn't, you know, so she had it in her bag. But I think the kids had them. I think that we all got them around 12, 13-ish.
Okay, cool. Good. I've just that tallies, and I just want to try and keep her phone free for as long as possible.
If I was to hit rewind, I would say that would be a really good idea, because it gives, I'm no sociologist or psychologist, but I feel like the socialization that happens with phones, the perception of the outside world, the kind of seeing the world through your screen is skewed. The same thing as actors. You know what, you know, you can watch a film you've done, and you know the edit that went in to create that moment, you know, because that's the second telling of the story is the edit. And there's so much, you know, taking 50 pictures to get one spontaneous, you know, a random shot. It's like, I think kids, I don't know. I think we'll find out in a number of years the impact it may or may not have had. My daughter rages against anything taking pictures. And we're going to, I'm in a juror for the Voice Arts Awards, kind of like the Emmys for voiceover, I guess. And we're going out there in LA. There's a red carpet a couple weeks.
Oh,
and my daughter's like, do I have to take pictures? Like, baby, it's a red carpet. She's like, oh. She does not post on social media. None of my kids do. They watch it for fun. It's not a, some of their friends, on the other hand, it's part of their social ecosystem. I don't know. I'm just glad that when I was growing up, part of it is there is no video or picture documentation of my mischief. So I'm kind of happy.
Fair enough.
The last question is, if you were to jump into a DeLorean, to go back in time, you're 16 years old, what piece of advice are you going to offer yourself, either to make life better in that moment or just get yourself on a different rail? You know, just some piece of advice maybe you think you needed to hear at 16.
I mean, I don't know if it would be a cheat, but I wonder if I could cryptically tell my younger self not to worry too much, that things would basically be okay. And certainly from an acting point of view.
I hear that frequently. That's a frequent thing. And I just wonder, it makes me wonder if worrying and stressing about the future is just a component part of the life of somebody who's creative. I don't know, because I hear that so often. It makes me wonder, is that, because I was the same way. It's like, what's it going to be? What's it going to be? What do I need to, you know?
But maybe the urgency that you had, maybe the worry is what got you where you...
Yeah, maybe that fuels the tenacity, maybe. You know, to keep after it. Who knows?
Yeah.
But no, Tom, I so appreciate you taking time out with me today. It's been more than a pleasure, and I'm
thank you,
really
Mark.
Looking forward to seeing Empire of Light. Thank you again, and you know, have a lobster roll for me.
Hey!
Since you are in Boston.
Will do.
I have never had one. I've gone my whole life not having a lobster roll, and I'm a food guy, so have one for me whenever you have a chance.
They're a big deal. I will. I promise.
But you have a wonderful rest of your stay in the U.S. Best of luck, and Empire of Light, most certainly looking forward to seeing it.
See ya.
Well, there you go. Tom Brooke, enjoy the opportunity to sit down and chat with him. Empire of Light, that's where you can see Tom right now. All right, that's it for the show. Enjoy the opportunity to connect with you. Of course, we'll be back soon. Another great episode. Don't forget, go to storyandcraftpod.com. That's where you can find out everything about the show. Send me a note, even a voice message. You can do that there as well. Please have a great rest of your week or weekend or whatever you're up to right now. And we'll see you next time right here on Story and Craft.
That's it for this episode of Story and Craft. Join Mark next week for more conversation right here on Story and Craft. Story and Craft is a presentation of Mark Preston Productions, LLC. Executive producer is Mark Preston. Associate producer is Zachary Holden. Please rate and review Story and Craft on Apple Podcasts. Don't forget to subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. You can subscribe to show updates and stay in the know. Just head to storyandcraftpod.com and sign up for the newsletter. I'm Emma Dillon. See you next time, and remember, keep telling your story.